So why Unitarianism? When you're thinking mango thoughts in a meatloaf town, and you're craving some jalapeno talk. My first response is that Unitarianism is a paradigm shift, and it's a vital one in our multi-religious, multipolar, postmodern world. Before the advent of modern technology, which has made us increasingly connected, it was easier to justify a belief that there is one unchanging right way of believing, and that's capital O, one, capital unchanging, capital R, right way of believing and being in the world. But now, with radio and television and the internet, we're more aware than any previous time in history, what's called our globalized world, that the more than 7 billion people on this planet are deeply diverse, multicultural, and pluralistic. In response to this diversity, Unitarian Universalism looks not to one singular source, but to 6 sources that form our living tradition. If you're not sure what those 6 sources are, they're written on the back of your order of service. Look at them not now, but later. They're there. And it's what we call our living tradition. That's why we symbolize it with a burning flame. It's living, it's growing, we're open to how it might change in the future. At the same time, I can respect the choice of individuals and communities who choose to focus mostly on one source, one way of being in the world. Great benefit can come from going deeply into Judaism or Christianity, Buddhism or paganism or humanism or other related paths. But I'll confess that given what we know in the 21st century, to me it only makes sense to commit to one of those paths with a fair amount of exclusivity if you make the all-important caveat that any single path is only one among many possible legitimate paths. And that's the vital paradigm shift in our 21st century world that it so desperately needs to keep us from killing each other. The shift from a search for the one true way for all people at all times and places to a realization that every way is at most one among many. That being said, let me hasten to add that being a pluralist who acknowledges that there are plural, many ways, legitimate ways of being in the world and of creating smart, funny, kind, competent, well-adjusted human beings, that there are many ways of doing that, that's not the same as being a relativist, as saying that just any way is as good as any other. And when I look at my own journey from conservative Christianity, which insisted that there was only one way, to liberal Christianity, which was much more tolerant of multiple paths, to Unitarian Universalism, which fully embraces and celebrates multiple paths all right here in the same building and makes us interact with one another, sometimes whether we like it or not. The primary motivation that kept me moving along that path toward pluralism was that the more I learned, the less I was able to maintain the position that Christianity was the only or best way of being in the world. The fancy theological term for this perspective is the scandal of the incarnation. The scandal of the incarnation, which refers to the problem of defending the position that the history of the entire universe that's out there when you look through that astronomy telescope that John was telling us about, defending the position that the history of the entire universe turns on the life of one Jewish peasant who lived in one small corner of the planet more than 2,000 years ago. That worldview is somewhat defensible if one believes that Earth is the center of the universe, that the universe is 6,000 years old, and that the end of time is long overdue and we're all going to be left behind. But after the work of scientists such as Copernicus, Darwin, and Hubble, it's increasingly scandalous to believe that the history of the universe turns on the life of Jesus of Nazareth, even if we do still use him to date our calendar, right? We do literally center time on his life, as much as we continue to value Jesus' wisdom and teachings. But Copernicus showed us almost 500 years ago that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but merely the third rock from the sun. Part of a solar system that is on the far edge, the Milky Way galaxy, right, that spiral, we're out there on an edge. And we saw from Darwin that we're not a little lower than the angels, we're just a little higher than the apes. and deeply interconnected to the ecosystem of this one planet. And Hubble helped us show us that the, if any of you have seen that, if you haven't seen it, Google image it, the deep field, right, looking way back into time, that Hubble helped show us that the Milky Way galaxy is just one among more than a billion, more than 100 billion other galaxies. Decentering. Why Unitarianism? Decentering of Copernicus, Darwin, Hubble, and others. Because Unitarian Universalism is a tradition that has long encouraged its adherents to bring the best of reason and modern knowledge to bear on our religious traditions and to fully own what it means to be not the one, but one among many. Now, what I've given you so far is a fairly rational, science-based response to that question of why Unitarianism. And in many ways, though, the history of Unitarianism represents the leading edge, and it has for centuries, of attempts to apply the insights of the European Enlightenment to religion. So to hold both those things. We want to be religious, but we also don't want to deny all those things that Enlightenment rationalism has taught us. And Unitarian Universalism is a liberal religious tradition. And as some of you have heard me say before, the liberal turn in religion is precisely the move from authority vested in hierarchy, in community, in tradition, into you believing it because I say so as the religious authority, right? Or we've always believed it that way, or you just have to believe it because it's about we, not you. To authority based on reason and personal experience, what you know to be true because you've experienced it firsthand for yourself or because it makes sense to you. In the 1500s in Europe as part of the Reformation, in the 1700s here in North America, even before the American Revolution, our theological ancestors courageously demanded that the Bible be interpreted just like any other book, that it be submitted to the logic of reason and logic and the best of modern historical scholarship. And as I continue to learn more about UU history, one prominent pattern that I see over and over again is the similar stories of ministers who become liberal as they study the Bible closely for themselves. You heard this morning from Miguel Servetus in the 1500s. He had been taught to believe in the Trinity, but when he read the Bible for himself, he just couldn't find the evidence. So you see that over and over, ministers and lay people reading the Bible for themselves and coming to discover that orthodox claims about what the Bible says are undercut by reading the Bible itself. And it's no coincidence that the Protestant Reformation happened in the 1500s, just 50 years after Johannes Gutenberg in 1455 invented the printing press, right? So all of a sudden people had access to themselves. And our globalized world that I'm talking about, that why Unitarianism was a response to, we talk about Google is the new Gutenberg, right? It's changing the world because you can't ignore stuff anymore. You know, I have a friend that says, you know, that somebody will make some claim. He'll say, you know, that's one Google search from being called BS. You know, and I say the Bible here. I've been talking about the Bible a lot as opposed to other religious texts because through most of the 19th century, a major focus of Unitarianism was carving out a space for a liberal interpretation of the Bible and submitting it to reason and logic. Two major expansionary forces, as we continue to look out over time, that made Unitarian Universalism what it is today, that Judaism and Christianity are now our fourth source, not our only source, we have five others, are the 19th century Transcendentalists, who emphasize the Eastern religions and the importance of personal experience, as well as 20th century humanism, which even more strongly emphasized science and reason, and a focus on this world as opposed to any focus on the afterlife. Thoreau famously said on his deathbed, you know, they said, "What do you think's going to happen when you die?" And he said, "I'm just taking it one world at a time, one life at a time. Let's focus here." And the transcendentalism of Emerson, Thoreau, of Margaret Fuller, and the openness of science and humanism, again, are the reason that Unitarian Universalism now has six sources. Now, I'd be remiss if in exploring the question of why Unitarianism, you know, how did we get this really long name, right? If I neglected to explore why we ended up with this somewhat long and confusing name, which, of course, was exacerbated when the Universalists and the Unitarians combined, giving us an even longer name. But we'll get to the Universalists next week. Before our theological ancestors were called Unitarian, they were often called Arian Christians. Some of you remember the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century with Emperor Constantine. It was Arius versus Athanasius. So they were called Arian Christians because they agreed with Arius that Jesus was not fully human but a little lower than God, not co-equal with God and not pre-existent. So they're called Arian Christians or sometimes Socinian Christians. That also comes from the 1500s. One of our theological ancestors, Faustus Socinus, was one of the early people who said Jesus is fully human. So they were called Socinian Christians or Arian Christians, depending on where they were on that spectrum, both of which distinguished them from the Orthodox Christians, who held, starting again with the Council of Nicaea, that paradoxical truth, that mystery, that Jesus is somehow fully human and fully divine at the same time. It's basically the same, what I was always told as a Southern Baptist growing up. I'm like, I don't understand the Trinity, it's a mystery. You know, you'll understand it when you're older. And that became the tension, is that our forebears started to say, I don't accept that. I don't accept that it's a mystery. It doesn't make sense. And so that's where it's not biblical, it's not rational, and that's where the tension came. And looking at our history in the 1500s and the Reformation, we have Unitarian martyrs, like you heard of Miguel Servetus. He didn't play around. That book that he published that got him in trouble, it was literally titled On the Errors of the Trinity. Like, it was all right there in the title. And here in North America, decades before the American Revolution, you can see that our theological forebears, who also questioned the doctrine of the Trinity, they weren't always that bold. They just sort of stopped mentioning the Trinity, you know, and people started to notice. They said, you never mentioned the Trinity, and then maybe they got reported to the bishop or things like that. One of my favorite stories from this period is of James Freeman, who was the minister of the historic King's Chapel in Boston. Have you ever been there to King's Chapel? Very historic. If you're ever in Boston, try to go there. I see a few of you have been there. In 1785, he preached a series of sermons in which he revealed and confessed to the congregation his reasons for coming to disbelieve in the doctrine of the Trinity. Part of it was he couldn't find it in the Bible. He assumed he would have to resign, but he told them that his conscience would not allow him. He couldn't just get away with not mentioning the Trinity in sermons. He just couldn't continue to be the minister of a congregation that whose liturgy mentioned the Trinity multiple times every Sunday. He said, I just can't do this, so do I need to resign? The good news is the congregation said they agreed with him. And rather than asking him to resign, they voted to change the prayer book to eliminate all references to the Trinity. And that's a classic liberal religious move. If your reason and experience conflict with the liturgy handed down to you by tradition and religious authority, you change the liturgy. If you're a religious conservative, you keep the liturgy and decide you're wrong and the liturgy's right. And James Freeman, that story I just shared to you, is the story of how the first Episcopal Church in New England became the first Unitarian Church in the New World. If you're in Boston, you can again still visit it today. Now, as I mentioned before, some of the earliest terms for what we now call Unitarianism were Arian Christianity and Socinian Christianity. And the answer to why Unitarianism, though, is that in 1819, the Reverend William Ellery Channing, who has been called the single most important figure in American Unitarianism. How many of you have never heard of William Ellery Channing? It's totally fine if you haven't. I'll take some fault for that. because the question is, how well do we know our history, right? So we have Channing Chapel. Some of you may have noticed that our chapel is the Channing Chapel. That's why. William Ellery Channing, 1819, he traveled from his congregation in Boston to preach an ordination sermon for the new minister at what we now know today as First Unitarian Baltimore, Maryland. And he preached there his most famous sermon, arguably one of the most famous sermons in U.S. history, called Unitarian Christianity. Among the many important themes of this landmark sermon, which I'm told clocked in at around 90 minutes, my sermon will be shorter than that this morning. I'm also told, have any of you been to First Baltimore? It's very large, it's very echoey, they didn't have a sound system back then. I'm told that day, pretty much no one actually heard the sermon. So he was out there talking for 90 minutes, no one could really hear him, but they published it as a tract, and it just went like wildfire. I mean, it went into like 6 printings, translated into multiple languages. But what happened in that sermon, Unitarian Christianity, is that Channing finally just embraced the term Unitarian. But that didn't come from him, it came from the critics. It's like Anabaptist, if you ever heard that term, that means re-baptized. That was actually, they said you couldn't be baptized as an infant, you had to be baptized as an adult when you knew what it meant to follow Jesus. But what happened is their critics would actually kill them by drowning them. You want to be re-baptized? We'll drown you. So Anabaptist rebaptizers, but eventually they claimed that epithet as their own. That's what happened. We were called, "You're Unitarians," and that was a bad thing because that meant you denied the Trinity. But Channing said, "Fine, we're Unitarians." That's what happened in that sermon. Because from the perspective of conservative Orthodox Christians, the most important aspect of liberal Christianity was that they were rejecting the Trinity and this idea that Jesus and God were one and the same. But in that 1819 sermon, he embraced it, Channing embraced it unabashedly. The problem is that the term Unitarian defines liberals for what they were against, that they were against the Trinity. It doesn't clarify what they were actually for, which was an emphasis on Jesus' ethical teachings. They say, you're getting it wrong by worshiping Jesus. You need to do what he did. The point was to follow him, to do what he did in his time and place, in our time and place. So it didn't clarify that it was really what they were for was Jesus' ethical teachings of radical love and inclusivity. The liberals also affirmed and taught a much more positive view of human nature, so that's in contrast to the Calvinists, who said that humans are totally depraved. They said, no, humans are, you know, not perfect, they're finite, but they're capable of choosing the good of their own free will. They're capable of, and Channing did another famous sermon that you can also look up called Likeness to God, saying it's not just about emphasizing that we're totally depraved and totally other. Now, from today's perspective, what I like about the name Unitarian is that we can now view it as emphasizing unity. We can claim that, even if Channing didn't, unity in the midst of all our diversity. And although the term Unitarian was, again, originally coined by critics who were trying to define us by what we were against, we can also remember that even more important to our theological ancestors was our ability to choose the good with our own free will, to choose an ethical life, what's sometimes called social, economic, and environmental justice. We encapsulate that today in themes such as deeds, not creeds. It's about what you do, not about what you believe. Salvation by character, not by grace alone. And that we don't have to believe alike to love alike. Historically, you can further see the emphasis on unity and diversity and on right living over right belief through the names that we almost had. In the wake of Channing's influential 1819 sermon, Unitarian Christianity, the American Unitarian Association was formed in 1825. Channing claimed a name to rally around, and then 6 years later, you get the AUA, which eventually merged with the Universalist Church of America in 1961 to be Unitarian Universalism. But other potential names cropped up along the way, such as the Universal Church, that could have been us, the United Liberal Church of America, or the Free Church of America were all contenders. And I should be clear, especially in regard to that name, United Liberal Church of America, or what I've been calling liberal theology, is that although we are indeed a liberal religious tradition, liberal theology is about the use of reason and experience as more important than tradition or authority for religion. In contrast, conservative theology teaches that tradition and religious authorities should trump if your individual belief differs. But religious liberalism, rejecting traditional religious claims, doesn't mean that one is necessarily a political liberal. Indeed, one can be a religious liberal and a political conservative, as members of this congregation can testify. And I have a sermon planned in November that will explore some of those intersections. What does it look like when you mix up religious liberalism with political liberalism, and what does it look like when you mix up religious liberalism with political conservatism, and what does it look like when you have all three in the same congregation? So we'll look at some of that in November. It'll feel relevant with the election. Living in the midst of such unity and diversity isn't always easy, but it is vital in our pluralistic postmodern world. As Dr. King said, because we can never again live apart in this globalized world, we must learn somehow to live together in peace. The large house in which we live demands that we transform this worldwide neighborhood into a worldwide family. We must learn to live together as brother and sister, or we will perish together as fools. And as any of you with siblings know, living together as brother and sister doesn't mean you always get along. You have some of that jalapeno talk from time to time that Meg Barnhouse sings about. But it means remembering that we're related, that we're part of one another, and we're called to love one another. In that spirit, as we continue to live together into our collective response, why Unitarianism today, I'll leave you for now with the words of our Transcendentalist forebear, the radical 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, one of the Secret Six. He kept a gun in his desk office at the church because the basement of that congregation was part of the Underground Railroad. Parker wrote about the shift from religion as right belief to religion as unity and diversity and right action. As I read, listen for the ways that Parker, through the lens of liberal theology, is refining traditional religious views about right belief to reflect a focus on unity and ethics. He wrote, "Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. It's not just about us. It's temple, all space, not just the meeting house, not just the building. It's shrine, the good heart. It's creed, all truth, not just what was decided centuries ago. And it's ritual, works of love." Parker's text has been put to music. I'd like us to sing it together this morning. If you'll rise in body or spirit, we'll sing together hymn 1058, "Be Ours a Religion." She'll play through it once.